From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how the marriage of the humanities and medical science is benefiting patients and doctors as well.
Later, the former mayor of Oklahoma City, who thinks the success of the country is linked to the success of mid-sized metropolitan areas.
Cities can't ever, you know, think that they've solved an issue because, you know, tomorrow there'll be new issues to solve and you got to keep moving. It's one of the frustrations of creating a city and a better city is that you never reach your destination.
Plus, the director of Miss Bennett Christmas at Pemberley talks about the Milwaukee Rep production.
It is a little bit of a what-if story in terms of who these characters are. And at its core is really a who am I play and understanding identity and female empowerment.
And on Bubbler Talk, why has high-speed rail never happened in our region?
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Not long ago, there was a very public debate on Twitter between the National Rifle Association and an emergency medicine doctor. The NRA essentially contended the doctor shouldn't weigh in on matters of gun policy, while the doctor said it was precisely the place of his profession to weigh in. The incident was a very high-profile example of the willingness of doctors to enter the public discourse.
But Twitter is obviously not the only way physicians outwardly express themselves. Dr. Jay Baruch is an emergency room physician in Rhode Island. He's also a writer, the author of several collections of short fiction, and director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. He gave the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin this week and joined us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, God. It's great to be here.
What does teaching medical humanities look like in the program where you work at Brown?
It's a great question. I think that's the larger question is actually what does, you know, medical humanities look like in general? And I think it could be many things to many different people. I mean, for me, medical humanities, I focus heavily on the humanities part. And for me, the humanities is about critical thinking, you know, questioning norms, critical inquiry, thinking differently about problems, thinking about other perspectives and different points of view. And it's also heavily grounded in my clinical work. There are people who do wonderful theoretical work in medical humanities, and that's fantastic, and I love the fact that they're doing that work. My approach to this and my fascination with this work really is informed by the practical challenges and that I encounter in my daily work as an emergency physician at a busy level one trauma center.
Well, and so how do these kinds of issues and where the humanities intersect with them, how do they manifest themselves in a, you know, in a trauma level one medical center?
Well, for me, at the most basic level, it's about story, the element of story. You know, I come to this work as primarily a creative writer who found himself stumbling into this world of medical humanities. There was not a lot of people doing this work. One of the thrilling aspects of being out here is that Art Dersey, who's at MCW and directs the program Medical Humanities and Bioethics, was really someone who has inspired so many of us. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so thrilled to be out here. But it's really at the level of story, you know. And, you know, patients come to the emergency department with a lot of different reasons. If you come in a cardiac arrest, like, I know what to do. If you come in with a gunshot wound, I know what to do. If you come in with a terrible infection and your blood pressure is dropping, I know what to do. But the doors are always open, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And we know that our communities are experiencing challenges and our healthcare system probably could be in a better place. And there are a lot of needs that go unaddressed. And a lot of times people come to the emergency department with problems that are not apparent. They don't follow an algorithm. And what they bring is their stories. They bring their needs. They bring their expectations and their hopes. And unless you're thinking in that way, You're thinking about who's telling the story and why they might be here. You can miss some really important information that's actually necessary to be a great doctor.
It's interesting when you think about it. Hollywood kind of appreciated the storytelling possibilities around medicine a long, long time ago. And it seems that the medical profession only wrapped its head around them more recently.
Do you think so? That's a great point. I think if you look back, I don't know whether it's the fact that we're not recognized, they didn't recognize it previously, or maybe it's because we've had so many really wonderful physician writers or clinician writers who are producing great work and bringing attention to that. Is it maybe because of social media and we're seeing a lot more clinician writers, musicians, performers, people who are telling the stories of medicine?
Right, maybe it's more grassroots today than it used to be.
I think so. And I think also because of that, you're also getting, I think, probably more honest and authentic stories about the experiences. You know, it's oftentimes there isn't a big happy ending. There's not a big moral or lesson to be learned. Sometimes it's just people struggling to get by. And I think that's an important message to get across too.
Well, it's interesting because I've been reading and seeing a lot in the media, you know, both social media and you know, more the news media from the community of emergency physicians, you know, in the wake of events like mass shootings, some of it in response to each other. So the community of physicians responding to each other, and some of it in response, you know, to pundits and you know, more societal speaking. But the point, I mean, maybe the point of the question isn't to talk politics and issues, but to just notice that we seem to be seeing more doctors participate in broader social discourse in more ways today than we once did.
Yeah, and I think that's probably for a couple of reasons. One is, as we discussed earlier, is this social media and people have platforms to investigate these issues which they're passionate about. Also, I feel that technology is also pushing the boundaries of what falls under the boundaries of what it means to be a physician or a clinician. I mean, before, you know, our level of concern was in the emergency department. But now we realize that a lot of quote-unquote health problems, medical problems, really have community issues. There's social justice issues, and I think there are a lot of physicians out there who are actually doing a great public health work. And it's also a way to connect and communicate with our communities in a more powerful way rather than just sort of dealing with them when they come through the sliding glass doors.
Was there a light bulb going off moment for you when you realized that you could weave these two parts of your life together as, you know, a doctor who writes or a writer who practices medicine?
I don't think that a light bulb necessarily went off. I think there was a slow flickering and then it just sort of stayed on longer and longer. And this, you know, happened, I think, years ago, and largely the result of my frustration, because a lot of the things that made me frustrated when I was taking care of patients were often those problems that was really fraught with uncertainty. And I didn't have an answer, and it didn't feel good. And I soon recognized that, you know, not all patients wanted answers. Sometimes they just wanted someone to talk to. Sometimes they wanted an understanding. Sometimes they wanted someone who was going to be able to sort of listen to them and maybe just share their struggles with them. And sometimes it was just to recognize that they're not a body full of biomedical problems, but a person. And I started thinking more like a writer. I was borrowing a lot of my writing skills and taking it to the bedside. And that not only helped me with my feelings of anxiety when I was facing situations fraught with uncertainty, but I also felt that it allowed me to engage with my patients in a way that felt more natural to me.
I gather the program at Brown goes beyond just writing as what the medical humanities look and feel like.
Well, medical humanities encompasses many different facets, skills, curricular objectives. I mean, it can be writing and focusing on story. A lot of the work we do is also focus using museum objects. We do a lot of work with the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD Museum, which basically we use visual objects as complex bodies of information to get clinicians, students, to get them to think about how they think, how they process information. We have people doing work with illustration, and I think the opportunities that fall under the umbrella of the humanities, especially at medical schools across this country, are expanding.
When do students at Brown first engage with the humanities as part of what they're doing in med school?
Well, there's a little bit of a complicated question. We accept a certain number of students into the medical school who actually go through what's called the PLEMI program, the program in liberal medical education at Brown. And many of them are doing humanities-related work as undergrads. Mm-hmm. And so I have the good fortune of encountering many of them when they're young, you know, and they're full of their passions, and they have the good fortune to be able to continue a lot of that work when they enter medical school, and they encounter it in bits and pieces throughout the curriculum. There's a lot of electives that they can take, and there's a lot of opportunities with many people at both the medical school and at the university at large who are doing great work.
Is there, and this is maybe an unfair question, because when you are a patient, your aim is to be helped by your physician and your medical team. And at the same time, I wonder if there's also some room that a patient would be best suited to give his physician in the same way as a reader, you know, gives to the art or to the book, or the person viewing a painting gives to the art.
You know, we talked earlier about the role of social media as ground roots for physicians to engage with a lot of the problems and challenges that they see facing their patients. I feel social media and technology has also helped change the discourse in which patients themselves are helping to drive the conversation. There's so much about being said and heard about patient empowerment, and that's so important. I mean, it's one thing to be able to listen to a patient, but thinking about it through your own eyes, but processing it from what they're saying. And another thing to really authentically listen to what our patients are telling us, and letting their voice be the final say, and being open enough and being savvy enough to recognize that even though there might be things that you do not like hearing, it's really important to recognize and understand that there are people having experiences out there that we can't truly understand fully. That doesn't absolve us from making those important gestures to understand it as best as we can, but we have to honor them, and we have to give it legitimacy, and we have to learn from what they're saying.
I know physician burnout is a significant issue in the medical field, especially in places sort of already underserved by medicine. I wonder, when you are able to engage this other part of you, this writer part, are you a happier or more fulfilled physician?
That's a great question. I used to say that there was I used to think, or I used to convince myself, that there was no bearing on the two. But I do feel that when I am I'm a better physician when I'm writing. And I'm trying to unpack why that is. It could be having that space to myself. It could be because I'm thinking about issues in a more intimate way. Oftentimes I'm going to pretty dark places in my writing, at least as the basis for moving forward. But I've burnt out, right? And I burn back in, and I burn out, and then I burn back in. And I think what's important is to recognize that sometimes, like, when you're truly human and you really care, especially in this system where it's oftentimes not designed for the better of patients, nor is it necessarily designed for the health of physicians. I hope things will change. That to be able to have these opportunities to reflect, to think about, to let it get out of you into some space. For me, it's on the page. For others, it might be in a painting or video or a blog or a podcast or 5 mile run is absolutely essential, but it doesn't change the fact that we do have some structural changes that have to take place in medicine, I think, to improve the health of our patients and the providers.
Well, Dr. Jay Baruch, thank you so much for spending some time with us and really kind of shedding light into how the humanities makes a difference in what you do.
This is so great. I'm really excited to be here in Milwaukee and to be participating in this lectureship. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jay Baruch is an emergency room physician and director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. His most recent book is a short fiction collection called What's Left Out. He was in Milwaukee this week to give the 13th annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
If you were tempted to think Milwaukee has turned its fortunes around for the better, the former mayor of Oklahoma City has some cautionary lessons to impart. We'll hear what he has to say when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The history of almost every American city features a series of boom and bust cycles. Milwaukee in the 1950s was a bustling manufacturing metropolis, but the city's fortunes fell in subsequent decades, and while the downtown has made a recovery, other aspects of the city are still a work in progress.
It is a story Mick Cornett recognizes. Cornett served 4 terms as mayor of Oklahoma City from 2004 to 2018. That city was virtually on life support in the 1990s, but is a completely different place as a result of several key policy decisions and some specialized taxes voters approved. Cornett believes it's a recipe other mid-sized metropolitan areas could follow as well. His recent book is called The Next American City, and Mick Cornett joined us on the line. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be on with you.
So I actually want to start this interview by asking you about the end of your book. How do you see the story of mid-sized metros and Oklahoma City in particular paralleling your own story? I mean, this is about reinvention, isn't it?
Well, it is. I went through a period of my life. I thought I had the greatest job in the world. It's what I always wanted to do growing up, and that was be a television sportscaster. And I was living the dream, and at some point, especially after the bombing that took place in Oklahoma City, and I just realized I wanted to do something different with the second half of my professional life. I was assigned to go cover City Hall, kind of fell in love with local government, felt like that's where a person could make a difference. And I left television, started my own business, ran for city council, and then ultimately served as 4 terms as the mayor. So, yeah, it's kind of been a reinvention, and I now that I'm not the mayor, I've got this book out, but I'm looking at, what adventure do I have left in me?
Well, and so when we look at cities like Oklahoma City and other cities its size, the Milwaukees of the world, but also the Buffaloes and other places, what you're really writing about is their ability to reinvent themselves.
Well, that's right. Everybody loves the rags to riches story, and almost every city out there is always evolving. You're either going one direction or the other. Oklahoma City's probably come as far as fast as any city in the country, but that's because it had a long way to go. I mean, you go back to 1990, and Oklahoma City probably had the worst economy in the country, and things are different now. And I watched some of my predecessors work, learned from them along the way, and then tried to stand on their shoulders and move the city forward. But cities can't ever, think that they've solved an issue because, tomorrow there'll be new issues to solve and you got to keep moving. It's one of the frustrations of creating a city and a better city is that you never reach your destination. You've got to always keep planning and always keep inventing. And here's what's interesting to me, Mitch, going forward, is that over the next couple of decades, you're going to see these mid-sized cities like Oklahoma City and Milwaukee have great opportunities to attract the millennial generation and the generation coming in just behind it. And what it appears is that they are more attracted to cities that size than the big cities, New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. They want to be able to afford a house. They don't want to spend their hours in traffic congestion. They're looking for a better quality of life, a more urban environment, less auto-centric lifestyle. And that's where opportunities like Milwaukee and Oklahoma City have opportunities to kind of continue to plan purposely about what type of cities we want to have.
Right. You were talking about where Oklahoma City was, say, 25 or 30 years ago. For folks who haven't been there, can you kind of contrast what it looked like in 1990 or 95 with what it looks like today?
Yeah, it was desolate. I mean, the downtown core was just emptied out. I mean, there were some tall buildings, people worked there, but at 5 o'clock when people went home, there was no nightlife. There was one hotel in downtown Oklahoma City, and it was struggling. Very few people lived downtown. There were no restaurants, no retail, and all of the life of the city was out of the suburbs. And we became a suburb of nothing, and the core was dying or was dead. And we had a business-minded mayor who realized we had to invest in ourselves. And so he passed an initiative that kind of started reinventing from a capital perspective in the inner city, amenities to bring people downtown. And it was a game-changing event. And ultimately, I think even though, you know, even today, most people, you know, don't live downtown. A lot of people do, but most people don't. People generally care about their neighborhood and they care about their downtown. There's an emotional attachment to the core of the city, and that's very important to get people to buy into some of the changes that are necessary. Because, you know, this highly educated 20-somethings, the group of people that I think all mid-sized cities are hoping to attract, they're highly selective. They're looking for a vibrant urban core. They want a walkable downtown and walkable entertainment districts and things to do. They want to be culturally relevant. And, you know, Milwaukee and a handful of other cities are set up to succeed if we do it right.
Right. So, I mean, I want to ask you about taxes, because I know you describe yourself as a small government conservative, and that seems pretty par for the course for Oklahoma. And yet it sounds like many of the successes Oklahoma City has claimed in the past couple of decades have come as a result of local government and sometimes business leaders being able to go to voters and making the case for raising money to do things. So, you know, what's the secret sauce? What's the argument that really resonates with people that makes them want to invest?
Well, I believe in efficient government and doing what you say you're going to do. And I think one of the success stories in Oklahoma City is that local government has developed a certain level of trust with the citizens. And we've largely used this taxation principle for capital structures. And people in Oklahoma City seem to have differentiated between the type of taxes they're willing to consider and the type they don't like. They like these capital programs where the taxation is for a certain number of years and then the tax will go away. We don't use debt in that type of funding formula. In other words, we collect the sales tax and then start the process of building these amenities. And so, you know, debt doesn't accumulate. And in a very conservative political environment, people in Oklahoma appreciate that aspect. But people just want, you know, they want their money's worth, and they want elected leaders who do what they say they're going to do. I mean, it's not complicated, but it's not universal. And I think that's one of the reasons that Oklahoma City has been so successful with its initiatives.
How important do you think it is for a mid-sized metro to have what basically amounts to a brand for itself, you know, to be known nationally or internationally for something or in some way?
Well, it's critical. And, you know, unfortunately, cities don't really control their brand or are not in complete control of their brand. You know, we had been branded by tragedy. When I was elected mayor in 2004, I used to travel and talk about Oklahoma City, and I could see on people's faces, the moment I said Oklahoma City, they had that image of the bombing from 1995. Then a tornado went through the edge of our city in 1999, and it was called the Oklahoma City Tornado. And so you have these horrific events that put a negative image on our brand. And so that's when I started going to the NBA and NHL offices in New York and starting talking to them about trying to get a major league city in Oklahoma City so that we could, a major league team in Oklahoma City, so we could start to work on our brand and get us associated with something positive. I mean, Milwaukee is well branded. I mean, through the decades, it's very strong in pop culture and people know it for different reasons. And that awareness is something that, that Milwaukee can build on and continues to.
Do you think are cities our size, Milwaukee's and Oklahoma City's and others, are they more susceptible to these boom and bust cycles that have happened over the years than New York or Los Angeles?
Well, probably, because maybe the economies are probably a little more similar. You've need to have a diversified economy to the extent you can. And in Oklahoma City, we spent 25 years trying to diversify, and it feels like we've finally done that. We had been such an oil and gas community for decades, and now we've invested in aviation and biomedical and tourism and things like that. So having a diversified economy is critical to avoiding the bust. You're always going to have the national economy being somewhat cyclical, too. So you don't need a local economy that's overly cyclical as well. I think that's critical, because if you go into any city and you look at the architecture and you look at the most important aspects of the built environment, generally they're built in the good times. And you can kind of look at architecture in a big city and kind of determine when they had their good times and when they didn't.
I'm curious whether this phenomenon exists in Oklahoma as well, and you'd be in a good position to kind of understand it. Is there a rural-urban divide that exists? I guess the question I have is whether, you need to bring the rest of the state in on ensuring the success or the success of its major metropolitan areas, and how you convince, rural Oklahoma that what's good for Oklahoma City is good for them, or in a place like Milwaukee, Milwaukee and rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think there's a rural-urban divide in almost every state in the country, and we've seen that in Oklahoma as well. There is a role that the big cities play, and there is a role for smaller and rural communities to play. And what we need, I think, at least part of the answer, and I'm not saying this is something that's easy to solve, but what we need is elected officials who are trying to bring people together. I think it's important that, we don't continue to divide up at every opportunity. We have so much partisan politics and so much divisiveness at the national level. At some point, we've got to come together, and hopefully that can be at the local level. And so people, regardless of whether they're urban or rural or whether they're Republicans or Democrats, can realize that our community, our state, is not going to go forward unless we get more people pulling on the same rope. But the funding at the state capitol, I know, is critical. And, on an annual basis, it seems like there's rural legislators and urban legislators who are fighting needlessly and not in the best interest of the state as a whole.
All right. So I am curious where you see the story of Oklahoma City's civic weight loss effort fitting in this bigger picture.
Well, that was an awareness campaign that I launched 10 years ago when we were showing up on the list of the most obese cities in the country. And I think as an awareness campaign, it's done a tremendous work. And now, here 10 years ago, we're seeing our health statistics in the city improve. So, that's been a journey that I learned a lot along the way and wrote about in the book. I think it's an example of how you can take something that's a negative statistic or a negative image or something that's tough to overcome, make it positive and try to make it in a whimsical way, something that people can rally around. I believe positive energy is important if you're going to institute change. And when you're talking about obesity, it's hard to find positive energy, and we were able to do that.
There's something in the idea of leading by example as well.
Well, yes, I suppose so. And I've had people say that my own weight loss journey was a critical part of that story. And I suppose that's true. But, I think some things, require a conversation and some things we don't want to talk about. And I think obesity is one of those issues we're not comfortable talking about normally. And what I did was I went to the zoo and I stood in front of the elephants and I told the entire city I was putting them on a diet. And we were going to lose 1 million pounds. And sort of the whimsical nature of that, I think, put a positive spin on a very difficult issue. But it created a conversation. Suddenly you had a community that was talking about a very tough issue. And talking about it, obviously, is the first step in addressing it.
Well, Mick Cornett, I appreciate the conversation that we've been able to have with you. I wish you best of luck, and thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much.
Mick Cornett is the former mayor of Oklahoma City. He's also the author of the new book, The Next American City, The Big Promise of Our Mid-Sized Metros. And we should note that despite a lifetime of living in Oklahoma, he is a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan. We spoke with him last month.
After a short break, we'll learn about the play opening tonight at the Milwaukee Rep that imagines the characters of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice gathering for Christmas a couple of years after the events of the original novel. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Most of us know the titles Sense and Sensibility, Emma, Pride and Prejudice.
And many of us have seen the masterpiece theater or film adaptations of those novels. Who was your favorite Darcy?
I will decline to answer. But the play opening tonight at the Milwaukee Rep is not your typical Jane Austen adaptation. Miss Bennet, Christmas at Pemberley is actually not an adaptation at all, but a modern play by Lauren Gunderson and Margot Melkin. That is a sequel to the events depicted in Pride and Prejudice.
We recently chatted with Rebecca Hurd, who plays Mary Bennet, and with Kimberly Senior, the director of the show. Senior sets up the premise.
What Lauren and Margot have done is given us a wonderful story of a family of, well, four sisters in this case, because their fifth sister is not visiting, and they have all come home for the holidays and are trying to carve out private time with one another in a public space at a stressful time, being the holidays, which is also full of joy. That's the quick version of it. The characters are characters one might recognize from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, although the events of the play are not related to the original Austen. And it is a little bit of a what-if story in terms of who these characters are. And at its core is really a who am I play and understanding identity and female empowerment.
And Rebecca, you play Mary, who is essentially the protagonist of the piece and through which all the change happens, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because we've talked a bit about that actually this is quite a bit of an ensemble play. Everyone, Kimberly has a great line when we're in the room about, like, we're all the hero of our own story. So when we enter the stage, we're bringing on our own energy and fighting for what we want. And it's interesting also because Mary, she is different. And she doesn't have quite the same social grace, perhaps, as the rest of her sisters do. And so that's why she's sort of regarded as maybe an outsider. But you kind of see throughout the play what's going on underneath. And actually, she doesn't really change too much about who she is. I mean, she has these experiences that shape her and maybe allow her to be vulnerable in a way that she maybe hasn't before, but actually it's not a man who comes into her life and suddenly she's this new woman.
I hadn't thought about how actually little your character changes.
No, yeah.
The other characters go through way more of a journey. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a book that gets referenced a bunch in the play that is about how we adapt and adopt in order to survive, sort of a precursor of Darwinism. And
right.
And it's Mary doesn't.
Yeah.
Mary's like, actually, I'm not gonna change to suit my environment,
right.
which if anything makes her the hero in that way. But as a result, the world changes shape in quite a beautiful way, and how we understand our relationships and our loyalties and our obligations and our connections and how we. Right, like the best thing another human can do for you, whether it's a familial bond or a romantic bond, is to hold the mirror up and mm-hmm. say, like, what do you see here? And I think this is so much a play about that mirror. And Mary does a lot of holding of the mirror for others as well in the mm-hmm. play, and how her sister's yeah. change is quite beautiful.
Yeah, she's the truth teller.
Mm-hmm. She's the Cassandra of
yeah,
the play.
Yeah. Yeah, and the world adapts to her, which is really cool.
But I think that maybe the journey is smaller for her, but there is, towards the end of the play, maybe the play allows her to open up to
yes.
her experience
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
It doesn't change, maybe, but it allows her to express parts
yeah,
of herself.
Yeah, at the
herself.
Beginning of the play, she thinks nobody understands her. And
right.
at the end of the play, she's like, all these people understand me.
Yeah.
So it's like, I say a lot that the last scene of the play is the first scene of the next play. And so it's like, in Mary's next play, she's going to be like, she's not just going to walk into rooms and people assume that she's insane.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, like, and the play is this day. The play starts today because Mary is suddenly overcome with this feeling of, I have to voice these concerns that I have about my future, about not having a choice. That, you know, I think for growing up, she had her role within her family.
We should say this takes place in 1815.
Right.
So the choices for women were even fewer by a great deal than they are now.
Right. And sort of by default, she sort of got placed into this role of being the caretaker for her parents and just expected that she's going to be an old spinster in an attic and not get married and not have any kind of, yeah, because you needed a man to have the choice to see the world, to travel. And those are all of the things that that is most important to her is this curiosity that she has to see and experience the world. So she's placed in this position of having no choice. And it isn't until the sisters leave the house when her older sisters get married and Kitty's off in London and Lydia's off with Wickham that she has space. She has time to think about. She has 2 years because this play takes place 2 years after Pride and Prejudice. She has the space to realize, wait, is this going to be the rest of my life? Is it just me and Mom and Dad in this house? And I think with that peace and quiet around her, she's able to say, actually, no, I want more. I want more than this, and I deserve more than this.
And that's probably the most important part of that sentence, I deserve more than this.
Yeah,
but the play is also a champion of solitude.
Yeah.
And that there's nothing wrong with enjoying your own company. And I think that that's a very hard message for women even today to understand. And that Mary's really cultivated herself in that time. She's become a terrific piano player. She has read so much. She has traveled so far even in her mind. You know, as Eudora Welty has a quote about like, you know, the most daring can come from your own backyard. And she's actually quite confident and comfortable being alone. And I'm sure all of us can remember like the first moment that we were truly comfortable like eating a meal by ourselves, you know,
or going to the movies,
right? You know, like those and actually how great it felt and that you had done this thing and how sort of brave that was and, you know, not having the paranoia that someone's looking at you and thinking like, oh, that poor thing is alone. They must be a spinster. And there's something about Mary who's very content in her solitude that I think is a very powerful message and what the marriage that she and Arthur may end up having I don't think looks like the Darcys or looks like the Bingleys or looks like the Wickhams. You know, it's going to be theirs. And I think also the play is teaching us that there are many different types of romantic partnership as well.
Yeah. And I also love you mentioned it kind of in passing. Some of the literary references that come in besides Jane Austen, The Mad Woman in the Attic. I was thinking of that particular image.
We can tie like every piece of literature. I mean, I've gotten Fiddler on the Roof in there.
Have you?
Wait, what are some rather wonderful? Well, I mean, Three Sisters all the time.
We're talking about Three Sisters quite a bit.
Yeah, Hedda Gabler I got in there. But I mean, we've really brought in the musical theater canon more than one thought we might. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, that may have come from the transitions too.
Yeah. And my love of musical theater.
Yeah, of course.
We'll talk about the transitions. In the script itself, it's the scene transitions. They're obviously a very important part of the world of the play. What are you doing with them that doesn't give away too much?
I mean, first of all, I love that Lauren and Margot have given, they've done a little bit of storytelling. Like, not every playwright does that. And I will say, every time a director is sitting down and working with a play that has multiple scenes, like it's one of the first things you have to tackle as a director about how am I moving from one scene to another. And obviously there's like 1,012 ways to do that. And some you can rely on your tried and true methods. And then other times you really have to think about what that is. So it is a really exciting part of the storytelling that you get to do as a director. I don't like calling them transitions. I like calling them interstitial constellations because there's so much more than just moving from one scene to another. And certainly time passes, but life is also lived and felt deeply in the home. And so partially I was thinking about how what Lauren and Margot have done with the play is they have subverted a lot of our notions of what 1815 looks like, of what marriage looks like, of what gender both discrepancies and parity look like, of what being in a family looks like. They've turned a lot of things on their head, and it's not with a clever wink. It's with real sincerity, but that subversion made me think, well, right, because we're watching the play from 2018. It's not like a piece of museum, you know, stuck behind glass storytelling. So our 2018 lens has to be in there somewhere. And so I feel like what our interstitial constellations are doing through a tremendous collaboration between fantastic choreography by Joey Stone and our sound designer, Nock, who has been composing music that both includes 2018 while honoring the period of 1815 and the wonderful storytelling, and then my greatest influences, which involve things like Lucille Ball, The Three Stooges. Mm-hmm. There's some Carol Burnett bits in there. Yesterday I watched the play in rehearsal, and I turned to my assistant and I said, I think this just might be a play full of things that I love.
Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, like I hope other people like those things too. We're drawing from a lot of different resources, and I think that the transitions are a place where you see that, yet it still feels holistic. It's the inner energy of the characters, and it's their dream spaces. You kind of get to see the inner life of the characters manifested in this really fun way. So it harkens back to the scenes, and it moves us to another space and time, but they are unexpected. They are not your mother's Jane Austen.
Yeah.
Well, not your grandmother's Jane Austen. Maybe
well,
your
mom. And the play itself, just reading the lines, not looking at transitions or anything like that, or the interstitial constellations, which is a fabulous phrase. That's a good band name, by the way. Mm. I think that should be.
We have a band photo as well, so we're ready to go.
We do.
There you go. I was going to say, there's the band name right there. But, you know, the play itself is not your grandmother's Jane Austen.
And they're performing, you know, look, everyone is speaking in dialect and they're wearing period costumes and the set is honoring those things. But even then, a lot of times in the design, we talked about the silhouette of the period. Like the colors, I think, are a little bit more outrageous in a way. And there are some things that we've done that kind of explode the notion. It's like the period plus. Even in their performance style, you know, where we're less concerned with, like, bowing and
perfect
curtsying,
gestures, yeah.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. And much more trying to get at Mr. Darcy's a line that yesterday I loved so much about, like, your heart has so much more truth to tell. And I feel like that's kind of what we're getting at. And, you know, the thing is that there's a, I think, an inaccurate period chastity that people put on plays that take place. And as we know, they could not have been that chaste or we would not be here today. So, and in fact, there was much less of a surveillance culture, right? So I think people were a lot more free. None of us were alive then, so who are we to judge? But I've really been encouraging the actors to rely on things like impulse and kind of that inner metabolism and the molecular needs that they have, because those are things that I do think connect us through time and through centuries and connect us to one another today. And so I want there to be a lot of access, and I want anybody. Again, Gunderson and Melkon write in the introduction that Jane Austen is for everyone, and that feels very important to me. And so I feel like that's true in their behavior as well.
Yeah, and I think that allows a lot of really fun, bold, unexpected, surprising moments to happen on stage. And being in the room and seeing your friends just be clowns and be so lovely and in the moment it's such a joy to be part of that room.
Oh, and then I have not stopped crying yet at the end of this play. After I've like belly lapped, like, I mean, our dialect coach yesterday at intermission was like, my stomach actually hurts. Like her stomach muscles hurt. I mean, Rebecca and I do need to take a moment to just talk about the incredible company of actors that we're working with.
Yeah.
And each one so different than the next, but also so game to try anything. I mean, the physical comedian prowess we have in that company, but that there's such an electricity and a limberness, a mm-hmm. like real athletic approach that's happening yeah. in the room that's really like you kind of can't look away because they're so dynamic.
And what it sounds like to me is that, you know, you're stripping away that masterpiece theater overlay of what we think this is going to be.
Right.
And you've touched on it. It's also a very funny script. It's just hilarious,
yeah.
And I was imagining as I was reading it how much fun that you guys are probably having doing it.
Rebecca has most of the best lines, and I think her work of like the next 2 weeks is being able to like say them without cracking herself up.
there are a couple good ones, but it's interesting because there's so many different kinds of humor in the play. It's like if you like physical comedy, great. If you like the little one-liners,
the underplay, what I call the drive-bys.
Yeah, the drive-by like, underplays. Yeah. You just kind of let that go, and then there are the Jane Austen references too. That you know. Refer back to Pride and Prejudice.
Set them up and knock them down.
Yeah.
I mean, even just looking at like, I didn't even, Bingley and Darcy, another huge Statler and Waldorf of the Muppet Show. They like remind me of them all the time.
Yeah.
They're this great sort of like comedy pairing, you know, the straight man and the...
Yeah. Well, and it's also written in there too, that the two of them would do that.
Right.
You can absolutely see that. Absolutely see that. Well, I can't wait.
Yeah,
I
we can't wait to have you.
To see it. So and ladies, I want to thank you both, Rebecca and Kimberly, for coming in, taking some time away from rehearsal to talk with us. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you so
it's
much
our pleasure.
For having us. This was fun.
Rebecca Hurd plays Mary in the Milwaukee Reps production of Miss Bennet, Christmas at Pemberley. Kimberly Senior directs. The show has been in previews all week and opens tonight on the Powerhouse stage. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break and then Bubbler Talk goes off the rails. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk. Quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I don't just want jobs that are created in short term based upon a government subsidy. I want jobs that are long term and sustainable. And the most sustainable jobs, 75% to 80%, are likely to come from small businesses, not from employers getting government subsidies.
I'm Joy Powers, and that was Governor Walker speaking to reporters in 2010 about an issue that has been on the minds of many Wisconsinites, including one who wrote into Bubbler Talk. They were curious about why there isn't a high-speed rail line connecting Milwaukee with other cities in Wisconsin and the region. The answer is complicated, but simply put, there was a plan for a higher-speed rail line, but Governor Walker was against it. Rob Henkin from the Wisconsin Policy Forum first came to the state in the 90s to work for a group that focused on transit. He explains the origins of this higher-speed rail plan, which came out in 2004.
There was a very carefully laid out plan, a Midwest Regional Rail Initiative, that essentially saw Chicago as being the center of sort of in a wheel, so a spoke approach, where there would be higher speed rail connections between Chicago and Milwaukee, heading then west to Madison, so connecting Milwaukee and Madison and going then all the way to Minneapolis, higher speed rail between Chicago and St. Louis, higher speed rail to Detroit, and throughout the Midwest. And once upon a time, you had 9 Midwestern states that were all on board, no pun intended, to actually try to lobby together for the federal government to allocate federal resources to do this whole Midwest rail initiative.
And they succeeded. At the time, Governor Doyle was able to secure $810 million, earmarked by the Obama administration to help create parts of this system, specifically a line connecting Milwaukee and Madison. But there was a problem. Kevin Muse from the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission explains.
When Governor Scott Walker was a candidate, he made one of his platform planks stopping that project. So when he was elected, actually Governor Doyle stopped the project the day after the election in 2010.
During his campaign, Walker made it clear he thought the project would be a waste of money. There were other transit issues he thought were more pressing, like fixing Wisconsin's, quote, crumbling roads and bridges, as he put it in 2010. The operating bill for the train was projected to be $7.5 million a year, which he felt was too high a burden. For perspective, Wisconsin's DOT budget for 2015 to 2017 allocates more than $3 billion for roads. According to Kevin Muse, there's a common misconception about transit's ability to make money.
No mode of transportation pays for itself, but for some reason we have a perception that the automobile does, whereas transit doesn't, which is inaccurate, but that certainly is the perception.
At one time, mass transit was profitable, but that's no longer the case.
50, 60 years ago, you had private companies running rail systems and able to make money. Some argue that because we have so heavily subsidized highway building and automobile usage, that meant the private sector couldn't make money running rail systems or any type of transit systems.
The money earmarked for a higher speed rail in Wisconsin was given away. Other states in the Midwest accepted the money and used it to update their rails and make them more efficient. It's unclear what a higher-speed rail could mean for Milwaukee, but Muse says it really comes down to connectivity.
You're providing the connectivity that helps the economy move and makes it easier for people, in this case, to move around and access jobs more easily, shop more easily, access education more easily, which is good for the economy generally.
The question now, what will it take to get a higher-speed rail system in Wisconsin? The answer, a confluence of political will, funding, and a plan. And we already have the last part.
The Department of Transportation still has a passenger rail plan.
It's called Connections 2030 and was first developed in 2009 before Walker took office.
That passenger rail plan has basically two dominant corridors from Chicago to the Twin Cities, connecting Milwaukee and Madison and communities in between, and then from Chicago to Green Bay, including connecting to Milwaukee and the Fox Cities. They've got specific plans. That would be 110 mile an hour service, so many trips per day. It's all spelled out in the plan. The political piece of it is a real challenge to figure out what the future holds.
Making these kinds of plans a reality takes a lot of politicians across municipalities, state lines, and political divides coming together to make them happen. Our current political climate may make that seem unlikely. But Rob Henkin says it could happen, and the federal government may once again want to earmark funds for the initiative.
Since the Trump administration came in, there's been talk about infrastructure maybe being the issue where the Republicans and the Democrats could agree. And now, in the wake of the elections, there's talk again that infrastructure may be one of the top agenda items in Washington. And if that's the case, might it include a high-speed rail component again? Hard to say. I guess there's a slight possibility.
But if it isn't part of the federal plan, then Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota would have to come together to raise the funds, which Henkin says could be prohibitively expensive. The person who asked the initial question that started this piece wanted to know two things: why there isn't a high-speed rail in Wisconsin, and whether or not it was something that would ever come to the state. And the short answer to both is political will. We don't have one because politicians decided it wasn't important. We could have one if politicians decide it is important. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Milwaukee, serving more than 41,000 children and teens each year. Dedicated to providing safe spaces, academic enrichment programs, and fun environments. More at bgcmilwaukee.org. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and assistant producer Maddie Andre, with the support of digital producer Lauren Sigfusson.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, Emily Files, Chuck Kornbach, and Taryn Powell. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be along with us tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.